Okay, hopefully we have a few more joining, but I see some of you on, which is great. My name is Molly Marin. I'm the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. Just a reminder that all upcoming professional development offerings are listed on our webpage at nysrti.org. You can look under Current Professional Development or Current Webinars. A copy of today's PowerPoint and handouts are available on the webpage. I did put the link in the chat to make it easier for you. If you want to go out and grab those, please feel free to do so. During today's presentation, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And if you're not familiar with the chat box, the little white bar at the bottom is where you can type into, and when you press enter, your question or comment will appear in the chat. We are very pleased to have Dr. Catherine Stahl with us to present our first webinar in the Strand 17 series, Fostering Reading Comprehension. I'm sorry, not our first, our second webinar, Fostering Reading Comprehension for Children in Grades 3 to Grade 6 at Tier 1 or Core Instruction. Today's topic is Close Reading, Trend, Travesty, or Tool. Dr. Catherine Stahl is a clinical professor of literacy at New York University. Dr. Stahl studies the effective instruction of reading in the elementary years. She is committed to improving student achievement and school effectiveness, especially in urban settings. She is currently the director of the NYU Literacy Clinic. For over 25 years, Stahl has taught in high-poverty public elementary and middle school classrooms. The questions that she researches stem from those experiences and from current classroom observations. Her research examines reading acquisition and reading comprehension. Dr. Stahl has written 5 books related to literacy instruction. She earned her Ed.D. in reading education from the University of Georgia in 2003. And at this time, it is my pleasure to welcome back Dr. Stahl.
Thank you very much, Molly, and welcome to all of you. It's great to have you back again and to continue our conversation about reading comprehension. Our agenda for today, our day today is going to be divided into 3 parts. The first section will be reviewing. I see that a few of you were with us last week. And so since we do have a small group, I really do want to review your reflections and your personal discoveries that after the presentation last week and after you had an opportunity to read the articles, for you to share with me your own reflections and discoveries about comprehension strategy instruction, and also provide the time today. Last week was very chock full of content, but that we do have the time today, and I wanted to have the opportunity to discuss questions that arose after reading and reflecting. And so the first 20 minutes will be devoted to discussion, a follow-up to our discussion on that very important comprehension strategy instruction. Then we'll spend 20 minutes talking about the role of close reading in a comprehensive comprehension curriculum. Close reading, last week we talked about pendulum swings in reading, and we all agreed that close reading is something that we might not have deliberately done 10 years ago, but that it is ubiquitous in classrooms in grades, any classroom above grade 3 in today's Common Core culture. And we will talk about what effective close reading practices really look like. And then our last 20 minutes will be devoted to the importance of questioning. I think that is one of the areas that really spans both the content areas, whether you're talking about literacy or whether you're talking about content areas, the craft of questions and how we use questions and questioning in classrooms, whether we're doing close reading, whether we're doing strategy instruction, or whether we're just stimulating a compelling conversation with our students, that the value of asking good questions and follow-up questions is really something that influences all of learning in our classrooms. And so we will be addressing that. Molly did put up, you see that the website is there if you have not already retrieved the resources that we'll be using today. The article that was our foundational article for our conversation last week and that we'll be referring to today in our revisit of the comprehension strategies and your own personal experience around comprehension strategies, will focus on the Stahl article, Today's Comprehension Strategy Instruction, Not Your Father's Automobile. Then there is another article that you have in your package that you can download or take a look at is something called, it's a close reading synopsis. And it was really something that I found in my research in preparing for this webinar. And I thought it's designed really for, I think, university teachers. But I thought it gave a very clear synthesis in very clear terms about the function of close reading and what the parts of close reading should be. And I just thought it was really clear and quick. It was almost like a little Cliff Notes version of what you should do and not do in close reading. So I've included that in your package. Last week, I referenced something called a skyscraper article. And so I've actually included that in your package this week because I think it just does a terrific job of teaching children how to ask good questions, but also even clarifying for classroom teachers and teachers. It provides some tools for helping improve our own question generation. And then everyone loves Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry, and they have done such rich work related to the Common Core, asking good questions, and close reading. So I've included, you know, their books are phenomenal, but I've included a little article from them. It's a very brief article about text-dependent questions. And so I've included that in our package. And finally, I've included something that I have generated myself. You know, I go and I visit a lot of schools and work in schools. And, you know, I'll say to them when I'm visiting schools or observing them, they're like, are you using the release questions? You know, the ELA, the New York State ELA test, they actually release those sample questions. And to be frank, the questions, I know some people object to the questions, but I think the questions are pretty darn good. And because they are really thought-provoking questions. They are questions that dig deeply into text. And so I ask teachers, do you use those questions? And I often get hymns and halls or where do you find them? Or, you know, so I feel like these released questions are not being used to their full advantage. So what I did for the schools that I work with is I created a little cheat sheet. And so I went through all the released questions in grades 3, 4, and 5 from both 2015, and then I just redid it for 2016. And so I have provided for you a little cheat sheet that has a lot of the kinds of high-level questions that you frequently find on that New York State test. And I know that there will be new people writing the tests for this coming year, but like we spoke about last week, high-level thinking is high-level thinking, and it's not going to change no matter what company is producing the materials. And so I have included my own little cheat sheet for those ELA test questions. Now, let's get acquainted and see who's with us today. So, Molly, if you would display our poll for us, and so describe what your role is, classroom teacher, interventionist, literacy coach, principal, special educator, school psychologist, L teacher, or speech language therapist, or a district administrator of some sort. Okay, I think I'm still waiting for someone to respond. We have 3 responses in. There's one person that may be maybe they're printing their materials. So we have some interventionists and special educators. So that's great. And let's go to the next slide, which is grade levels that you work with. Grade levels that you work with. Yeah, I suspect you folks work with everybody. Fantastic. Because our presentation today is not grade specific. So, fantastic. Okay, Molly, we can be finished with that. Okay, so now is the time that I would like you to begin typing in. Now, is there anyone on today that was not here last week? I mean, these names look very familiar to me. So Type in and say hello if you were not with us last week. Yeah, that's, I thought, Angela seemed like a familiar name. So, Angela, I hope you stick with us, though, because we'll get to close reading, and I think still some of this review of materials you might find useful, especially I always think it's useful when we listen to others and think about some of the same strengths and weaknesses and things and that they celebrate as well as our challenges. You know, I think we learn the most from other people, not just from somebody like me dropping in. So what I'd like everyone to talk about now is when you were reading those articles or in response to comprehension, the comprehension instruction, what were some things that you discovered that you could do well? So why don't you, Diane, Kathleen, and Molly, jot in some things that you do well, and let's do those things first. And Angela, when it comes to comprehension instruction, you can certainly feel free to jump in there and say what you think is one of your strengths as in comprehension instruction. You know, you certainly know yourself and can jump in. So how about the others, Diane, Kathleen, and Molly, in deep reflection, what were some things that you thought that, that were very affirming? Well, yeah, I do that. This is something that I do with my students. Higher level discussion, so important. Diane and Molly Mark, I'd like to hear from you. Oh, graphic organizers is a weakness. That's interesting. Interesting. It's nice that we have a small group so we can really feel like we're talking to each other and make and personalize this. Oh, so tapping prior knowledge and interactive note-taking. Now, is that a comprehension strategy? I'm not sure. Tapping prior knowledge with a strength. Oh, so those are your strengths, the interactive note-taking, explicitly teaching strategies. Okay, those are the strengths. Okay. How about challenges? What are the things that you find challenging to do in your teaching summarizing, Molly? I hope you'll try that GIST strategy and see how that works for you. Because kids need to know how, even for like a lot of the other activities, if you want them to fill in a story map, if they can't do summarizing, they can't do the story map. So that really is something in that stopping and taking stock. I know one of the strategies that we found the most difficult, and this is, I think, one of the reasons I like to focus on this, one of the strategies that we found in the research that I did with David Pearson and Barbara Taylor and Georgia Garcia, I think that we found that of the single strategies, the question generation was the hardest for kids to really own. You know, they could ask the low-level questions, but not really the high-level questions, not what we called the thick, juicy questions. Transferring it. Molly, that is such a common difficulty. And in fact, in a research project I did, I found that children could even, and this was with second graders, they could even tell you what strategies they were using, but transferring it independently was problematic for them. So you are not alone. And then identifying the exact point that a student is confused or struggling. Yeah. And I think that's hard in comprehension because, as we talked about last week, it's an unconstrained skill and it's a moving target because sometimes, you know, if it depends on the level of the text, it depends on the content, how much prior knowledge the children have. So really identifying what is causing the child to have a stumbling block can be very obscure. And, the distinguishing what's important and not, that is, yes, Kathleen, you are so right. And I think the secret is really, I think sometimes we jump to new strategies too fast, that we really don't spend the kind of time in a gradual release of responsibility that the research shows is necessary. And so to do it in a sustained way, do one strategy, do that strategy in teach or read aloud, boys and girls, what is most important, what is not important, and maybe even making a chart on it. And then doing it in shared reading with the material that is your stretch text that you're reading together with their eyes on text. And then doing exactly what you did in the read aloud and doing it with a different text in shared reading and handing over more responsibility. Then doing it in the informational text. And so teaching in thematic units where you're seeing similar kinds of text throughout the unit is also helpful in dealing with this. So in our goal setting for the month of October, I think you've just specified what might be, you know, I think if we look at our chat group and we see your name and what you identified as a challenge area, I think that can be something that you could pick as an immediate priority. And when we evaluated, one of the questions I asked you to do last week at the end of our presentation was, I said, look over the month of October. Look over your month of October, and if you're an interventionist or a special ed teacher, talk to the teachers that you are working with their children, and what themes are coming up? What instructional units are coming up? And so in considering that, what two comprehension strategies are you going to choose as an instructional focus in October? So Molly, now is where you can put up our reading strategies for us. And teachers, you may actually select two of these that you decided based on your reflection and your personal research this week in what kinds of texts your kids are reading, what did you decide were going to be the two strategies that you were going to focus on in October to help your students overcome meaning-making hurdles this month? Fill in the poll. Okay, so we have summarizing, questioning, comprehension monitoring, and text structure. So good, we still have text structure and ideational prominence, that idea that Kathleen talked about, that's what ideational prominence is, that it's not just picking out a main idea. That doesn't get kids very far. You've got to know how to pick out the main idea, but you've got to know levels of importance, and that's what ideational prominence is getting at. And that's really, you know, and it goes along with also the text structure, all right? And then lots of summarizing and some questioning, okay? And I see one person picked up visualizing, and that's a good thing to do in the beginning of the year because that's relatively easy to teach, and it can get you a lot of mileage. It really is a strategy that can get you a lot of mileage. Okay, well, good. It looks like you have your goals set. And we will talk a little more about this later on. So in five words or less, and this is great because we have a small group, what I would like you each to do is succinctly in our chat box, in five words or less, just tell me your reason for why you selected those strategies. Oh, baseline data for the IEP. Okay. It's what the students need. Oh, good. We have a few other people joining us. Nice. I love that, Molly. It's what their classroom, so that that's a good way to have transfer. When I work with schools, I always get them to make up a map of what every classroom teacher has to make up a map of what their units are, and then what the content, and then what the strategies are that they're focusing on in the classroom. And I have them distribute that to the interventionist, the L teacher, and the speech and language teacher, and the special ed teacher. Because you folks, and I think everybody here is an interventionist of some sort, including special ed, which I also consider interventionist. Because your role is not to teach the kids necessarily the same content that they're teaching, but it's to teach the cognitive strategies that, who was it up here said this about the transfer to other, Molly, you said it. So what we want in the intervention setting, in the special ed setting, is to be teaching the strategies, the cognitive strategies children will be able to transfer to the content and the text that the classroom teachers are using or that they need when they're reading independently or in a small group. And so that is a good justification. And, you know, it's really that those comprehension strategies, you know, are applied. We want them applying them. As we said last week, the goal is not to be able to write a summary. The goal is to be able to summarize and synthesize information succinctly, tapping into the key ideas. And that you're really, that summary is also we talked last week about Walter Kinch's construction integration model and how you take the prior knowledge, you mix it with the text-based information, you integrate them together, you prune incorrect information that you may have had, and prune unimportant information, and you come out with what he calls a situation model. And so what we want good readers to be able to do is to really be able to succinctly, both in verbal expression as well as written expression, it succinctly tell what that situation model is. Okay. And we want kids to be able to apply it on an as-needed basis. So now we're going to shift into this prevalence of close reading in classrooms. And this really stems from a couple areas. It stems from a couple things. First of all, our first anchor standard, and like I said last week, this isn't going anywhere. This is, you know, the ability that we want children to read closely to determine what the text says explicitly and to also make logical inferences from it, and to then cite specific textual evidence when writing or speaking to support conclusions drawn from text. So when we make an inference, what makes you think that? I can tell you, and anybody, any of you who have been around education for any length of time, know 20 years from now, this anchor standard, it may be called something else, but it still is going to be an instructional goal. So this isn't going anywhere. I don't care how much we change the standards, and I don't care how much we change the tests. This is not going anywhere. But this is where that read closely and that close reading came from. All right. It came from the verbalization of it in the strategy, and it also came, we'll talk about that in a minute. It also came, let me back up, from David Coleman and E.D. Hirsch. We'll get there in a minute. So what exactly is the role of close reading? Okay. And this is one of your new handouts that you have for this week. It's what I call the Cliff Notes version of Cliff Notes version of close reading, and its audience is university people, but I think it's a pretty good synthesis of close reading. And they say that the role of close reading is to understand the general content of a text, even when you don't understand every word or concept in it. And that's really important. We want our special ed students and our Tier 2 and Tier 3 students in that general ed classroom when they're doing stretch text, when they're doing close reading, because comprehension is never all or nothing. And one of the roles of close reading is to understand content of a text, even when you don't understand or can read every word of it or concept in it. Close reading is also to spot techniques that writers use to get their ideas and feelings across and to explain how they work. And the third function of close reading is to judge whether techniques the writer has used actually succeed or fail. And it's also an ability to compare and contrast the successes and failures of different writers' techniques and expression of ideas. And so I think that's a pretty good summary of what the role of close reading is. And this is the Cliff Notes version that you have on your website that you can refer to and see. Now, the origins of close reading also do come from the university, from academia. You know, just like we want children to investigate the context and the authors, that's what we do in close reading. I hope all of us do it as professionals. And if we do, that we know that E.D. Hirsch, who has made those core knowledge and amplify materials, and David Coleman, who is an architect of the Common Core, we know their background. They were English literature teachers. And so, of course, they value close reading because that's what college students do to prepare for a discussion or to write a paper about a literary text. Yes, that's where close reading came from. And the prevalence of it now. David Coleman wrote that note to publishers. And so when publishers set out to make Common Core materials, one of the activities that they included a lot of was close reading because of David Coleman. However, that is a very powerful tool for literary text, but we're not asking kids to just read literary text. So, and this is what I also liked about that handout that I gave you, that Cliff Notes from Washington about close reading. Before you take on the task of reading any sort of text, you'd better make sure you understand the practices of the discipline and the requirements of the assignment. So most of the close reading that you are going to be doing is probably of literary text. If you are close reading for social studies or say something like that, I know that in the, and I forget the name of the document, the human rights document that the materials on Engage New York have in that fifth grade unit with Esperanza Rising, and they also have the human rights document. Well, you'd better understand social studies and historical standards and criteria for what counts as evidence and what they value in building historical knowledge, because it's different than literary knowledge. And so anytime you do a close reading with your students, you had better figure out what the discipline is, what they value in knowledge building and in their discourse, capital D discourse, how they talk, read, write, and think in service of building knowledge. And it's not all the same way that literary and David Coleman and E.D. Hirsch have experience with and are advocating for. So Tim Shanahan has written in his blog, if you don't follow his blog, I recommend that you investigate it. It's really some wonderful writing. Tim Shanahan has a wonderful classroom sensibility. He is very versed in a long history of reading research. He's a true researcher and has been in developmental reading research for a long time. And his blog is always very insightful and usually very humorous. So if you want a good laugh as well as some good information, check out his blog. But he has several. He has at least 3 to 5 blogs that address close reading. And he specifies close reading is not a teaching technique. It's simply a kind of reading. And the other thing is that in this January 12th blog, he actually reviews a video of a teacher doing a close reading. And he certainly is saying that the video is good, that the teacher is doing some good stuff in her close reading. But close reading is not the place to teach comprehension strategies. That is the place, and this is where I think it's important to discriminate the kind of close reading that David Coleman and E.D. Hirsch want us to do. They only have experience in doing it with college students who already have comprehension strategies under control. If you want kids in close reading, they have to bring strategic processing to the task. It's not the place for you to teach close reading, but they need to have had the kind of instruction that I talked about last week. They better have that under control and be developing that, because you don't have the time to do a bird walk and teach comprehension strategies in close reading. Those are two different pathways. Now, also, close reading should only be applied, and this is from Brown and Kappas, who actually wrote a little handbook on close reading from the Annenberg Institute for the Common Core. And they say close reading should only be applied once or at most twice during a whole comprehensive unit of study. And these are the David Coleman buddies who actually wrote a guidebook for the Common Core and close reading. And they are saying close reading should only be applied once or at most twice during a unit of study. Not every day. And surely not with a novel. Like I've actually walked in classrooms and seen people doing close reading of Esperanza Rising every day. They told me it took them 8 weeks to get through the book. That is not the appropriate use of close reading. I love what Doug Fisher says. Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry say, in elementary school, when you're doing close reading, that text should be short. If it has a staple in it, it's not appropriate for close reading. If it's a book, it's not appropriate for close reading. It should be a one-pager, folks. So, the elements of close reading. First of all, you need, and this is again from Brown and Kappas that actually wrote the guidebook for close reading for the Common Core. First, a brief, high-quality, complex text. Secondly, okay, so the first reading that you go through, you're reading for the gist. You're reading for the key ideas, all right? And that doesn't mean that you're not reading for inferences, but it's really for the big ideas, the macro level comprehension, and it can be either individualized or assisted. But again, even if kids are special ed or in there, it should be some kind of assisted reading. You're not reading this for decoding practice. You're reading it for ideas. And so whatever level of assistance is needed, whether it's having the teacher read it, you know, I prefer that the teacher not read it aloud, but maybe choral reading, because it's going to be a short piece. So a choral reading might be appropriate. Putting kids in a small group and have them read it as a small group. Doing partner reading might be appropriate, or even having some kids read it, you know, the special ed kids read it or listen to it on an audio tape, or read it with a teacher in a small group. Then you do a group reading of the piece of text, all right? You read it via the group. Then you're going to have a teacher-led discussion, text-based questions, and text-based questions still are inferential. It's not all right there questions. And a discussion for the discrete elements or standards, okay? Now you're focusing in on particular standards. And also, close reading should also include student discussion and also written responses to text. So there needs to be student-led discussion and also written response. So these are the elements that should be found in a close reading. Here's how Shanahan summarizes it. During the first reading, you're looking again for macro-level comprehension, key ideas, and details, all right? And that includes your standard one, which is inferential thinking as well. Second reading, you're going through the text for craft and structure, all right? Text structure, why did the author choose this text structure, and so on. Craft, you might be looking at the way the author used language, particular words, what kind of discourse is the author using. And then finally, in the third reading is where you're really going to do your evaluative analysis and compare to perhaps to other texts or other movies and so on, or to real life. So those are the elements. But again, remember, it's a short text, so that's why you're able to do three readings, all right? And not all texts are worth reading. Not all texts are worth doing a close reading of. Now, if you are using, you can certainly use an excerpt from a longer text and do a close reading of it. That would be very appropriate. If you're reading Esperanza Rising and you pull out, say, a powerful passage that really talks in some way about Esperanza's deep feelings, or that in this passage talks about how she has changed as a human being, and has some powerful language that the author has used, that's certainly appropriate and a good use of close reading. Other things are poetry make good vehicles. Primary sources like that human rights document, short stories, internet articles, all right, to actually show children how to evaluate a piece of an internet source, short videos. Don't eliminate videos. You know, that was something to very do a close viewing of, because the same kinds of levels of thinking are required, and speeches. But not novels. Now, here are some very interesting articles that generate some concerns about close readings. Fisher and Fry, 2014, had a very interesting article. Snow and O'Connor, 2014, they present a research and theoretical perspective. Hinchman and Moore, talking about adolescence. This was probably in the Journal of Adolescent Literacy. And then I had an article in the Reading Teacher that focuses on what counts as evidence that is not specifically about close reading, but it talks about how when you are reading when we're reading literary documents, one thing counts as evidence. When we're reading scientific documents, other things count as evidence and are valued in knowledge building. And when we're reading historical or social studies passages and work, we need to use a different set of criteria in our close reading discussion. a literary discussion should sound very, very different than a discussion of a primary source, a historical source. So some of the concerns that those authors generated were balance. And here's this first one, or these are my words, not any of their words, okay? I always like to ask teachers the question, did that close reading, did it suck the life out of that piece of text that you had, or did it breathe life into it? I think that is the key question as to why you're using close reading. Did it suck the life out? Did you just, you know, just talk about it to death? Did you suck the life out of it? Or did children leave the close reading enthused and inspired by the text, wanting to do more with it? Background knowledge and academic vocabulary. Too often, I think, close reading is done as a 25-minute exercise in a classroom, and an isolated piece of text is pulled out, and people are doing this close reading exercise with it. Close reading needs to be embedded in the content that you're teaching so that children already have the background knowledge and academic vocabulary. I was in a presentation once where we did a close, we grown-ups, reading professionals, were asked to do a close reading of The Great Colossus, which is a great poem that I think is also included in that same fifth grade unit, because it's talking about the Statue of Liberty and the immigration experience and comparing it, I think, to a Greek, you know. So, but if you don't have the background knowledge, you're having to explain all that to the children as part of the close reading. So you really don't want to, you don't want to do this isolated close reading as practice in how to read for the test, for the state ELA test. You don't want to do that. You want this to be purposeful, to really breathe life into a piece of text that is part of an existing unit. The other thing that you need to think about, as we just said, is I think that privileging a single source. I'm going to tell you, when you're reading a piece of literary text, you want to examine how Philip Roth or a poet used language. Maybe there's power in that, but I'm going to tell you, if you are reading a historical document, you cannot read a single piece, do a close reading of a single document, because the whole nature of building evidence in history and social studies is contextualizing that and looking at and comparing it to converging evidence and points of view. And so if you're saying to a kid, cite the evidence for this claim, and all they have is one document, that flies in the face of historical knowledge building. And so you are actually defying what a historian and reading and thinking and talking like a historian is really about. Next, time allocation related to close reading. Yeah, okay, I told you that in that one school I was visiting, they said, well, our children, we did close reading of the whole Esperanza Rising book. And it, I said, how long did it take you to get through the book? 8 weeks. 8 weeks. Folks, and I said, well, I just can't imagine that that was engaging for the children, dragging it out over 8 weeks. And that's a good book. I mean, that is a fabulous book. It's a classic for a reason. However, 8 weeks? And they said, oh, no, the kids loved it. And however, I don't care if the kids loved it or didn't love it. What was the cost in term of time investment? What did you have to let go of? What did you have to forsake? What did you have to forfeit if you were spending 8 weeks reading Esperanza Rising? If you were spending 2 weeks doing a close reading of some other piece of text? what is being forfeited in the name of close reading? So, how do we do effective close reading? First of all, it is whole class and it's heterogeneous because we do want we want a complex text. In order for it to be worth a close read, it does need to be a stretched text at those high lexile levels. And we're showing kids, right, you may not understand or even know all the words, but here are some of the key things you can take away from this text and how to approach it. You want to support reading as needed because this is for comprehension. You also must situate it within your disciplinary units, be it literary units, social studies units, science units, to ensure that students have the background knowledge, the vocabulary, and the standards for what counts as evidence in this discipline. They need to be short texts that are pieces in a larger academic unit. And one or two close reads ranging from 2 or 4 days per unit, okay? So you do not want to do in one unit only everything in a close reading. And you want to have dedicated time for discussion and dedicated time writing individually in response to that close reading. So you've done the close read. You know, kids come in, they have the macro level comprehension. They acquire learning by communicating and talking with each other, by talking with the teacher, by digging in deeply. But then there needs to be, for some of the close reads, a written expression individually after that that expresses how our thinking has changed and expanded as a result of the close reading. Writing is a part of it. And then finally, I would say that you really want to craft the questions and prompts thoughtfully, which leads us into our next topic, which is questioning. So the questioning in the Common Core, you know, is very similar and is based on the gold standard, the NAEP. All right. And even all the ELA tests are based on this now. All right. So in the NAEP, we had the NAEP framework was understanding, interpreting, and applying. And all of their questions on the NAEP fit into one of those three categories. And the Common Core is the same. Standards 1 through 3 relate to understanding, 4 through 6, interpretation, and 7 through 9, application. So if we want to ask powerful questions and to teach kids to ask powerful questions, Bloom's Taxonomy is a preliminary guide to levels of thinking. All right, it's an old standard. It still works. And in fact, the article that I have presented, that I have included, the Skyscraper article 2004, very cute little article, explains each level of thinking in very child-friendly terms and provides a clear way to teach students to ask good questions using some frames and using a skyscraper. And so it provides, you know, last week we talked about the best way to teach kids how to ask good questions is to generate stems. And so the skyscraper actually provides high-level stems for each of 6 levels of thinking and responding to text. And that is Bloom's Taxonomy, recalling facts and comprehension. That's the lowest level. Then we have, now they have application next. And then analysis and synthesis, and finally evaluation. I would say that typically application is at a higher level that we have in here. I would say at the third level is analysis, then synthesis, then application and evaluation. But so this is Bloom's Taxonomy, and it's also found in the Skyscraper article to help kids ask good these kinds of questions that target this level of thinking. Fisher and Fry, you know, I don't know whether you have their book, The Use of Text-Dependent Questions. It's a fantastic book on the Common Core and asking good questions. And it says that, so they divide it up, you know, that when even when you're doing a close reading, what does the text say? Standards 1 through 3. How does the text work? That includes text structure and sometimes author craft. Why did the author decide to use this kind of language register? You know, whether it be sort of a street talk, whether you be using some other kind of register, for example, Southern dialect or other kinds of text craft. Why did the how is the text working, and why did the author choose to organize it and have it work, set it up in this way? What does the text mean? All right, this is higher level inferences. And then finally, what does the text inspire you to do? And this is where you could have projects yielded resulting from that. So those are, you know, some ways to enhance your question generation. And I spoke about the use of the release questions. Well, you have the cheat sheet that I'm sharing with you, my cheat sheet. So, how would you use this, or how would you recommend that other teachers use it? I would make sure that I'm asking these kinds of questions during read aloud, shared reading, and guided reading. I would use them as writing prompts. And I would use them during close reading activities. And most of all, I would use them when I'm formulating some common formative assessments. You know, that's really the direction that the common formative assessments are really the direction that PARC and Smarter Balanced and that the Common Core really want us to go into related to comprehension. There is not one test that can give you a comprehension score for a child. You know, we talked a little bit about this last week, that Lexile test, you know, if you're doing the Lexile test, you know, or doing a test that's a computer-based test like iReady or STAR or Dibbles or AIMS-Web, that is good enough to get a Lexile, all right? It's going to give you a range because unlike the foundational skills, there is not a mastery of comprehension and to say the kid is reading at this level. It's going to depend on all those pulse points we talked about last week. So really, your best way to assess comprehension is to, number one, in grades 3 through 6, do something quick and dirty that is not going to take up your instructional time, because God knows the children need the instructional time and comprehension. You do not want to be spending 4 days assessing kids to get a text level that is just for that text. That's not the best use of your time, your teacher's time, and to get a moving target. So use as little time as possible. Use one of those computer-based tests. Then get the more instructional information in by developing at your grade level common formative assessments. Okay, so let's say we just finished our unit on plants. So what I'm going to do is I'm going with the other fourth grade teachers, we are all going to develop an end of unit test about plants that is going to have some novel text that kids are going to have to answer. It's going to have some short responses, and it's going to have some extended response questions. And we are going to use my released questions to develop those questions. And that is where we're really going to get insights into how our kids are performing in comprehension. Because the only way that we know what they're understanding is by either what they say or what they write. So we've got to teach and measure the writing as we go, embedded into the comprehension. And so that's where we want to also use some of these release questions. We want, for every unit we teach, we should have our grade level should have a common formative assessment that is targeting the comprehension skills that we value. A final word about questions. Y'all, I have been teaching for 40 years. 40 years I've been teaching. And I would no sooner pick up a book off the shelf and read it to a group of students without having my sticky notes with questions and vocabulary words posted in the book. I would no sooner, I would never dream of standing aloud in front of a class and reading a book cold. After 40 years in reading, I would never do it. Why? Number one, there are a lot of distractions. And also, so there are a lot of distractions. I may not be asking the most important questions. I only have a limited amount of time and student attention. So therefore, those first questions that I spontaneously ask, if I ask those spontaneous questions, I may not have time for the most important ones. And I don't really have, I want to put all my questions down on a piece of paper and say, in the limited amount of time that I have, what are the key takeaways from this piece of text that I want to make sure my students come away with? What are the key questions that also tap into those comprehension strategies that are going to help them overcome meaning-making hurdles, not only in this text, but the one they're reading for their guided reading lesson, or that they're reading independently for their research project? So I want to craft and write those questions in advance. The other thing is that by having my questions crafted in advance, I can avoid the IRE interaction problem. What is the IRE interaction problem pattern? It is when we make an inquiry, the children respond, and then we tell them yes, right, or wrong. It's inquiry, child response, evaluation. And that is what most classrooms look like. We want to avoid that. We want to ask a few low-level questions to make sure they're on target and have understood the information in the text. But then we want to jump off, and then we want to really be truly listening to what the child answers and do follow-up questions to take the thinking to the higher level that the children could not get to on their own. That's Vygotskian practice. All right. And all of the research, whether you see research like the Beck and McCowan research with kindergartners and first graders in text talk, they insist use initiating questions, but then say make sure that you have an opportunity to do a follow-up question based on what the kid answered. And you have to be listening. You can't be fumbling thinking about what your next question is going to be. All right. Nystrand did a study in middle schools and high schools. He found the same thing. The most powerful questions are not the first question you ask, but it's the question that you or another child asks in response to what a child response is. And in order to ask a follow-up question, you truly have to be listening to the kids. So our next meeting will be on October 26th, and I do hope that I will be seeing all of you with us at that meeting as well. And I'd like you to take some actions between now and then. So, for example, related to our strategy instruction, now I would like you to really make a commitment. So select your two comprehension strategies. It sounds like some of you did that. And in your article, the Oldsmobile article, not your father's Oldsmobile, use figure 9.3 to record your instructional decision-making for each of your two selected strategies between now and October 26th. And since there are only four of you here, you can send those to me. I'd love to see them. That would be interesting to me. Choose strategies that are a good match for your upcoming curriculum. Don't choose the text based on the strategies. Choose the strategies based on what your kids are studying in their general ed classrooms. That's how you choose the strategies. If there are any administrators here, I don't think we have any administrators. If there were, I was going to ask them to observe three ELA lessons and use figure 9.3 to see what forms of interactions are happening in service to teaching comprehension. Goals for October 26th surrounding close reading. I'd like you to just jot down some notes. Over the next month, jot down some reflective notes. What protocols for close reading are used either in your own classroom or in your school by classroom teachers? What kinds of text do you see being used? Is the close reading being contextualized within units so that the kids have the necessary prior knowledge to bring to the close reading? Because in the close reading, you don't have time to teach content as well. So, or is the close reading being done as a silo kind of isolated practice of some sort? And finally, the big umbrella question, what are the consequences of close reading in your school? Is it breathing life into reading or sucking life out of reading? Now, some reflections. So you see how this is set up. So you're doing an action on our comprehension strategies. There, you're actually taking some actual instructional actions now. And then these things you are engaging in some reflection about, and some reflection and observation. Reflection and observation. Questioning, do you deliberately, and you may not be doing a read aloud, all right? But even in the, you say your guided reading lessons or your small group lessons with your own kids, the text that you're having them read, like even let's say you're doing some Newsela, that news ELA, and you're using those texts or read works, are you yourself generating the questions? The crafting the questions for the purpose for your group, not just the ReadWorks questions that some college graduate who didn't get a job wrote, but if you're using ReadWorks text, are you crafting the questions for your instructional purposes? Next, how are you doing with the follow-up questions to extend the thinking? You know, so often we, and by a follow-up question, I don't just, you know, you should be asking follow-up questions not only if a child got the answer was off target with his or her answer, but certainly that requires a follow-up question, not just going to the next kid. But even when the child gets the answer correct and has some good ideas, then you want to raise the thinking to the next level. Analyze both the quantity and quality of questions being asked. Sometimes it's asking too many questions. It would be better to maybe ask fewer, more targeted questions and crafting them to yield the most important takeaways from the reading experience. So now, speaking of questions, I'm ready for some of your questions or comments about how this, what you're seeing in your school, or even questions about your ongoing work yourself. Comments, questions. I'm not seeing anyone typing. Kathleen Ryan is typing.
Okay, and while they're typing, I'm going to post the link to the evaluation.
Okay.
Oh, wonderful, Kathleen.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. Thank you. You know, I like to see y'all typing. Even when I'm presenting, It's nice to see you typing something in so that I can address it. And it also lets me know you're there. It's awfully lonesome on this side of the screen. I'm there like, is anybody out there? So thank you so much for your feedback and for, you know, I hope that's a sign that y'all were doing some deep thinking about the ways that close reading is being used in your school and the way that questioning, you can actually enhance the questioning that not only teachers are doing, but children are doing too. Thank you so much for your comments. And I'll see you October 26th, and we'll do some debriefing then as well about some of your discoveries related to each of these last three slides. We'll do some debriefing before we start talking about conversation and written expression. And that'll be the topic for our next one. Our next our presentation on the 26th, we'll do some debriefing and follow up to some work that you've been doing this month on strategies and your reflections on close reading and questioning. And then we'll dig in very deeply to discussion and different kinds of discussion formats and student-led discussions and book clubs. We'll talk about all of those exciting topics, as well as written expression and how that really is such an important way that children need to learn to be successful and efficient in conveying their comprehension through their written expression and the different formats and ways that that can be included. Molly, could you now have you access the recorded audio and documents after this webinar is over? The way you'll do that, Molly, and also Angela, if you would like to revisit all of this stuff, you go into the RTI Technical Assistance website, the same place you got all these materials, and you look for prior archived webinars.
Seeing the link right now. That's the link for, because after today, this webinar will be a past webinar. All of our past webinars are found on that link, and everything has been recorded, so you could find a wealth of information really in on that page.
Can people hear you, Molly?
I hope so. Can you hear me? Uh-oh. Can you not hear me?
Yes, I could hear you. I just want to make sure they could, too.
Okay.
I'm hoping.
Oh, good. Okay. Everybody said yes.
I didn't know how this all worked.
Yes. I mute and unmute. So thank you so much, Dr. Stahl, for another fabulous presentation. We look forward to having you back on October 26th, and we hope that everybody can join us, and maybe you can get a few friends to join us as well. We'd love to have a bigger group. So wishing you all a good night, and thank you so much. And Dr. Stahl,
yes,
just hang on for a minute.
Go Mets. I'm headed to the Mets game as I leave here.
Oh, okay. We'll be quick. Hang on.
Okay. Thank you.